Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
Is that war rocket Ajax? To bring back his body?
Welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me as always is my co-host, Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you on this fine evening?
A little froggy in the throat still, but I am doing okay. I apologize to anyone that I don't sound perfect and pristine to, but...
You're a little froggy?
A little froggy.
You a little froggy fresh?
I wish someone had just got dunked on by me, but unfortunately, no. Chris, how are you feeling?
I'm okay. I'm okay. You can tell that I'm okay because my voice just went up super high when I said that. But still, I think people will understand what's up when we get to the checks and recs segment of this show.
Okay. And I assume still a little bit... sore from the various bumps and bruises in the MMA training. That is an ongoing thing.
The good news is that my right elbow is no longer hurting. The bad news is that now my left leg is hurting. So having constant physical pain is a great distraction from all my other troubles.
I guess that's why it's such a great anxiety cure, right? Because you don't have to, because you're in constant physical pain. All right, Chris, let's get to the show. We're doing a special one this week. We're going to be doing a listener question special where we're going to take all of your questions, or as many as we can, and try to answer them, because it's been a while since we've done that. That's going to be a lot of fun, answering your questions. But before we do that, we have some business to take care of. So, Chris, let us thank our newest Patreon supporters.
That is a good thing to do, Matt. Now, these are people who have gone over to patreon.com/warrocketajax and thrown in a couple bucks every month to help us pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills. We're only about 30 bucks away from having double length Every Story Ever specials every month. If that is a thing people want to hear about, they can head over there and check it out.
Yes, they can. And we were at around 50 away. But thanks to Paul Gilbert.
Oh, thank you, Paul.
We are a little closer. And we actually had a couple of our backers on Patreon bump up their pledges a little bit to get us that much closer to having double length Every Story Ever episodes. I don't think we're going to get there for this month's. We could, but we're going to have to record that episode pretty quickly, pretty soon. So hopefully, at the very least, we can get to double length Every Story Ever for October and get up to that $1,500 goal. Thank you to all our Patreon supporters. We really, really appreciate all your help. If you have a dollar or five to kick in on Patreon to help us get to that level, however, think about it. Help us do it if you can swing it. If not, we still appreciate you and all our other listeners just for listening and just for making War Rocket Ajax the wonderful show that it is. All right, Chris, we have completed our thank yous. Let's move on to some checks and recs.
Let's do it. So come on and take it.
All right, Chris, what do you have to check in with this week?
There's some big news. X-Men 92 was picked up as an ongoing series coming out of Secret Wars. It's going to start next year. And that was just announced, I think, about an hour before we started recording this.
That's huge.
It's very exciting. Scott Koblish is not doing the art for the ongoing. Chad and I are still going to write it, but Scott is off onto other projects. He was an absolute dream to work with. He was fantastic. But our new artist is also someone that we're really excited about. It's Ulti Fermansiah, who did the Star-Lord and Kitty Pryde miniseries for Secret Wars. We've written the first issue, and I think it's going to be really great. I think it's going to be really, really fun. the thing about the miniseries was that because it was Secret Wars and it was set on Battleworld, there were things that we couldn't do. Like our original pitch when we were first talking to Jordan and to Heather Antos, who is our editors on the book. Like, we were like, oh, yeah, like, the X-Men are going to go to Genosha, the X-Men are going to go to the moon, the X-Men are going to go to Canada, the X-Men are going to go to Latveria and Madripoor, and none of those places existed on Battleworld. So we pretty much figured out what we wanted to do. Like, it was always going to be Cassandra Nova, but it was going to be much more of a globe-trotting story. So we're really excited about the possibilities of what we're going to get to do in the first one. And I can tell you that in this first arc, you're going to see a couple of locations in Europe that are going to be really fun. You're going to see a new old take on a favorite villain of ours, which is going to be really fun. You're going to see a guest appearance by one of my favorite Marvel characters, which I'm really excited about. There's a lot that we are really excited about doing in the ongoing series. I will say that we've got a long-term plan, but I have no idea how much more we're going to be able to get to do. 'Cause, you know, comics. I do want to say thank you to everyone who supported the book. Obviously, Chad and I had a whole lot of fun doing it, but the reaction, the fan reaction, is what got us that ongoing, which is great. Thank you, everybody, for picking up. I'm so excited about working with Alti. We just started talking to her about stuff this week. I'm a little anxious. I think you can probably tell from the way I sound right now. I'm a little anxious about how it's going to go over and how it's going to be received, but we've got a pretty good amount of time before the ongoing starts to hit shelves. It's not going to be till next year. It's not going to be till early 2016, but I hope that that people enjoy it. Because, you know, those were our X-Men growing up, and you know that, but you don't know that until people start talking to you about those X-Men. thank you to everybody, and go check out the amazing cover by David Nakayama. He's the one who did the variants for the Secret Wars miniseries, the Lost Story variants, the one that had Dracula, the one that had Arcade, the one that had the toys attacking. His variant for the fourth issue actually came out today, which he faked a holofoil cover. We were like, oh, I wish we could do, like, I wish we could get a gatefold. Like, I wish we could get holofoil. I wish we could do something. And so what he did was he literally took pictures of, like, aluminum foil at his house and then, like, photoshopped it into this giant X. And I think my favorite thing about it is that it says fourth issue collector's item on it. But he's also done he's doing the covers for the ongoing series as well. And that first one is just the X-Men going up against all the villains that we have plans on seeing in the ongoing. So Apocalypse is there, and Omega Red is there, and Fitzroy is there, and Bastion and Fabian Cortez. So Cyclops is not in the book anymore. Cyclops is not on the team. Cyclops is on vacation with Jean. Cyclops and Jean are not on the team. But you can probably guess, if you are familiar at all with the X-Men, how well the Summers family vacation is going to go. So if you're a Cyclops fan, and I know there are some of you out there, look, he's Chad's favorite. He will not be gone long. So, like I said, I'm anxious about the announcement, and I'm anxious about how it's going to be received, but thank you, everybody, for supporting the book. Nat, what are you up to this week?
That's what I have to say about that announcement.
Oh, thank you. Like, what was that? Was that first one in the one?
Yeah, it was me turning. I always forget that if my phone is on vibrate, it doesn't work. So that was like the remnant of an air horn.
Let's see here. Let me load it up. Oh no, you're right. My phone's on silent and it's not working. There we go.
Yeah.
love that Mad Decent app. I still like every week.
I still love this guy. All right, that's enough of that guy. What's going on with me is I decided not to relax at all when I came back from a 2-week vacation because I immediately was sick when I returned, and that stuff is still hanging around in my head because I don't know why. And also, like the week after I got back, I started a new job, and I never talk about my day job on the show, and that's not going to change. I'm not really going to go into detail about the day-to-day work stuff that I do, but it has made the week a very busy one to the point where I've kind of lost track of time on other things, which you may notice in our comic segment. I'm turning into a practical Eugene here with how many weeks that I've just not been able to set aside the time to read the most recent comics for our comics reviews.
I'm hoping this means that you're about to drop the hottest album of 2015.
you wait. My solo banjo album is going to be crazy. I hope that is not a consistent thing. I hope it's just the past 2 weeks that have both, each of which have been nuts, that have kept me from reading the comics for the review segment. I should be back in great shape next week once I've really settled into the new job. The new job is going well. I'm enjoying it, and I'm hoping that it allows me plenty of time to continue to do all the stuff I need to do for Ajax. It seems like it's going to be that way, and to continue doing stuff for Comics Alliance and all that stuff. So that's what's been going on with me. Not super exciting, but in case anyone was worried that me taking on a new job might mean less Ajax or less stuff that I'm doing, I'm hoping that that is not the case. All right, Chris, let's make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend this week?
My recommendation, I think I hinted at this or perhaps outright said it in our last show. Mario Maker, Super Mario Maker. It's great. Now, Matt, you do not have a Wii U, right?
I do not.
Matt, what if I told you? What if I told you that if you bought a Wii U, you could play a theoretically infinite number of new Super Mario levels?
Yeah, I have heard about this game, and I'm familiar with and somewhat excited about it. Here's the thing, though, and maybe you can turn me around on it. I have never found the ability to make my own levels an enticement to play a game.
Okay.
That's just making me do the developer's job, right?
Okay. I haven't either. Like, whenever it's, you know, if it was like a Tony Hawk game, and it was like, you know, make your own skate park. I did enjoy making my own wrestlers in the WWE games.
Yeah, character is totally different than having to build your own levels.
But I have never played a game with a level editor that I have been interested in using before.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is Mario Maker's greatest achievement. It makes building the levels fun. There is a very seamless process between like putting something down in the level and then playing. Like, you hit one button on the screen and you play. Mario drops down wherever he is on the screen, and you can play through what you've built to the level. You can change stuff, and one of the interesting things about it is you don't get everything when you start. The game keeps track of what day it is, and what day it is determines what you can use. On your first day, it gives you the Mario, like the Super Mario Brothers 1 NES. Very basic tool set and a modern, you know, new Super Mario Brothers Wii U tool set. And you can only do, I think you can do an overworld stage, like a ground stage. And that's it. You get Goombas, you get Koopas, you get pipes that you can't actually go in, you get bricks and tiles. So the game's like, hey, why don't you try making something with this? Like, literally, when you start the game, it'll start you in a Super Mario level that's World 1-1, and then you'll get to a point where there's a pit that's too wide to jump across, and a little thing will pop up and say, oh, hey, it looks like somebody didn't finish making this level. Why don't you try it? Which, again, that is exactly doing the developer's job. But it encourages you to do that. And then in order to unlock the next day's shipment of things, like in the next day's tools and elements, you have to spend 5 minutes building a level. Like, that is the requirement. If you spend 5 minutes in the level editor, you can, you know, the next day you'll get the underground stage, and then you get the water stage, and then you get the castle stage, and then you get the Super Mario Brothers 3 stuff, and you get the airship stage, and then you get the, I think the next thing I'm going to get is the Super Mario World stuff and the Ghost House stuff. So it's bits and pieces that it doles out. Which, you know, you can cheat the clock. You can go in and reset your system timer and it'll be like, oh, it's tomorrow. You can have the other stuff. But I actually kind of like that it does that.
Yeah, it's a way to keep it from being overwhelming where you just have hundreds of tools and you don't really know what to pick because there are too many choices.
Yeah, exactly. And because, you know, Mario is... and historically has been all about incremental increases in difficulty and twists on things you know, right? Like, even Goomba to Koopa. You stomp on a Goomba and it's dead. You stomp on a Koopa, something stays. Then a Buzzy Beetle acts like a Koopa, but it's a little different. So they don't give you the Buzzy Beetle right away. You know, they don't give you the Spinies right away. They don't give you Yoshi right away. Because there's different things that are going on. So part of that is like... and part of it is level elements, too. Like, you don't get... moving platforms until I think the third or fourth day. I still don't have pipes that you can go into. I will probably have those by the time everybody hears this. It's all about little twists on ideas. So it's the game is about making you familiar with these ideas, and then you know you get to a point where you're like, oh man, I wish I could put a bullet bill here. I wish I could put like an invisible block here and do a little tricky secret area. But you don't have those yet, so you kind of have to think your way through the basics first. I think that part, like, I think they talked about it on the latest episode of Retronauts, and they called it the gamification of making games. which is really interesting, because it does make you think of things in different terms. It makes you get used to the basics before it gives you some other stuff. And then... regardless of what you have and what you have to work with, you can download other people's courses and play them. You can play them online. I think you can go in and edit courses with things you don't have yet, but you can only move around stuff that's on the screen. Beyond that, it's like you can just play them and you can play anybody's. And so obviously there's people out there who are making really hard levels. There's a ton of people out there who are making automatic levels. Where, you know, you don't press any buttons and Mario just kind of is pushed through the stage by environment stuff. Which is something that we've seen forever with, like, ROM hacks and stuff. But, like, getting to see it in this is a really cool thing. And you can even play through, like, a series of levels that the game will pick out from what people have made. One interesting thing about that is before you upload a level, you have to clear it. So there's nothing... there's stuff that's... impossibly hard, but there's nothing on there that can't be cleared. There's no broken levels in the game. There are just levels that are annoying.
There's nothing that is actually impossible.
Right.
Yeah.
The other thing that I really like about it, this is a nice little quirk of the game interface. If you like put a Koopa down, a green Koopa on the screen, you can like grab him with the stylus and you shake him around and he turns into a red Koopa. And so there are elements... that you, like, the piranha plants that just come out of the pipe versus the piranha plants that spit fireballs. Bowser versus Bowser Jr. Different things like that that you have to, like, things have alternate modes that maybe you don't think about. So you do kind of have to poke around and see, like, okay, what happens when I shake this box? Like, is it going to turn invisible? No, okay, I just don't have invisible blocks yet. That's, I think, really fun. And also there's things in there that are so intuitive that it took me forever to realize. Because, like, there are people... I played through levels, like very basic levels, that had like giant Koopas and giant Bowsers and giant Goombas. And I didn't realize you can take a mushroom out of the toolbar, and if you drag it into like a brick or a surprise box, it'll go in there. If you just leave it on the stage, it'll just be sitting on the stage. If you drag it onto a monster, it makes the monster double in size. So there are really, like, there are interesting things. Like, you can, if you drag coins onto a pipe, the pipe will just spit out coins. If you drag a 1-up mushroom onto Lakitu, Lakitu will throw down a 1-up mushroom instead of a Spiny. It's really fun to make the levels. I have uploaded 3 of them. The one huge bummer is that actually finding people's levels is a huge pain in the ass. It is a 16 number and letter code that you have to enter. Your list of people you're following does not auto-populate from your Wii U friends list, which is a pain. So you have to, like, get someone's level code and then star them as someone you want to follow within the game, and then you can go look at the rest of their stuff. Or just enter the code and go see what else they've made. That's kind of a pain. I have 3 levels on there. I'm not going to give out the codes on the show because it's ridiculous. One of them is called Goombas in the Pipes. One of them is called Uptown Downtown. And one of them is called Dark Dungeons, which is a tribute to Jack Chick, of course, which is my Bowser Castle level. So if you see those are mine.
And I'm sure, if a listener really wants to see those levels and get on there for Mario Maker, they can email us or contact us on Tumblr, and we can share that info, I'm sure.
I might go look up the codes and then give them to you to put in the show notes for this week so people can check those out. But if you're on the fence about getting Mario Maker and you do actually like Mario games, get it, because it's really super fun. It's all I want to do. Matt, what is your recommendation this week?
I'm going to keep this recommendation fairly short. I actually mentioned mine last week as well. All these recommendations have been foreshadowed. My recommendation is Spy, the movie directed by Paul Feig and starring Melissa McCarthy that came out, I guess, back during the early summer, late spring. I ended up watching it on the plane on the way back from the UK, or on the way to the UK, actually. And the way I described it to my wife, because I told her that she should watch it on the way back, is it's a movie that is instantly forgettable for a lot of reasons. The plot kind of purposely doesn't make a lot of sense. It's not the most coherent or cohesive plot, but the plot also doesn't matter at all. It's really just a vehicle for everyone in the movie to be extraordinarily funny. You've got Melissa McCarthy, who is hilarious and who actually plays, because she is a spy, gets to play a few different characters through the course of the movie. I don't actually even know her name, but she's another person who works at the spy agency. She's an English actress who I've actually only seen in the drama called The Midwife, otherwise, but she is extraordinarily funny in it. Jason Statham is in the movie. He actually reminds you how funny he is in the movie. He may be the funniest person in the movie. He is nothing but comic relief throughout the movie. You know, if you remember him from the early Guy Ritchie movies, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch and those movies, Jason Statham is really funny, and he is extraordinarily funny in this movie. Peter Serafinowicz is in this movie. He's really great. Rose Byrne is kind of the lead villain of the movie, and she definitely plays up the villainous stuff, but she's also just extraordinarily funny throughout the movie. It is just packed with funny people being funny. And there's sort of a spy plot going on at the same time, where they're getting to go globetrotting, and Melissa McCarthy is riding around on a scooter chasing after cars, and there are plot twists and, you know, all kinds of weird stuff like that throughout the movie. But it's just kind of 90 minutes of sitting and laughing for a while, more than anything else. Like, you won't really remember all that much about the plot when it's over, and that's okay. It's just a very enjoyable, funny movie. So if you have not yet seen Spy, you know, go grab it out of a Redbox or something, because it's a very funny film.
it is hilarious to think about Snatch and think about the idea that there was a time when there was a movie where Jason Statham was worried about not being able to fight Brad Pitt.
And he was asking someone why in the world they would have a gun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because of the Germans. He's so funny in that movie. It's and he's extraordinarily funny in Spy. Okay. That is it for our checks and recs. Chris, let's talk about some of the comics that came out this week.
Let's do it.
All right, Chris, I'm having to bow out of the comics review segment this week. It's all you. So let's start with the first comic that you said you wanted to talk about, which is Grayson number 12.
Yes, this book is amazing. It's phenomenal. It's great. I think if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that we really love Grayson. The stuff that they've been doing in that book has been really great, and it's all been building to this. Like, the entire premise of the book has been that, you know, Batman sent Dick undercover in Spiral. Dick faked his death and joined up with Spiral at Batman's request to investigate them. But then, you know, Endgame happened, and Batman has not been responding because Batman lost his memory, and he is just regular Bruce Wayne now. So this issue is all about Dick going back to Gotham City and kind of confronting and talking to Alfred and Bruce and Tim Drake and Jason Todd and Batgirl. And it's really, really well done. Every time he talks to one of them, every time the scene changes, there's a shot of just the person against a dark background, and there's word balloons. And they're all word balloons from previous stories. They're all word balloons from stuff going back to the Golden Age. Like when he sees Bruce, there's a balloon that is from Robin Dies at Dawn. When he sees Batgirl, there's one from Batgirl Year One. There's one from Batman Family. There's like all of these different balloons that kind of remind you, even though the universe, those universes might not exist anymore, like, it does a great job of reminding you of all the history of these characters and all the history these characters share. And I love that Tim Seeley and Tom King went back and pulled those things out from crucial moments. Because, you know, I didn't recognize all of them, but I did recognize a lot of them. And you know, like I said, it's Robin Dies at Dawn. It's there's a scene with Damian, too. So all the stuff with Damian is pulled from, like, Batman and Robin and from the Morrison run on Batman. So the way that it goes through with that and everybody's reaction, because, you know, Bruce doesn't know who he is anymore. So he goes to see him in disguise. Tim and Jason are upset because, you know, the Robins don't lie to each other. Batgirl, obviously the connection there is something different, but Damian is so happy to see him. And that was the scene that really, really got me.
Yeah.
Because that's his Robin. That's Dick's Robin.
Yeah, and Dick is his Batman.
Yeah, like, the thing that I always say is, you know, Tim Drake is the best Robin, and he's Bruce's partner. Like, Dick isn't his partner anymore. Jason was never going to work out, but Tim was his partner. With Damian, it's Damian and Dick. Like, they're the Batman and Robin of that team. They're the partners in that team. And so the reaction that you get from Damian seeing him, like, he slips up. He stops being Damian for a minute. And then it comes back, you know? And there's a throwback reference to the Clue Master Code that was in the Future's End issue, which I think was one of the best issues of the run so far. Certainly the best issue of the Future's End event. Just really, really great stuff. Well worth checking out. I don't know if you haven't been reading the book up to this point, this is not the one to start with. Because there's a lot of emotion and a lot of interplay that goes along with it. You'd be better off starting at the beginning. But also, if you're a longtime Batman fan and you've been missing the interaction of the Batman family from the pre-Flashpoint universe, then maybe this is one you should check out. Like, if you haven't gone and looked at it, maybe this is one that you can go into and be like, okay, this is an acknowledgement of how these characters interact. The stuff with Bruce is actually really great too. And I don't know if Scott Snyder has gotten enough credit, because it's all been overshadowed by, oh yeah, Jim Gordon is in the robot suit as Batman now. His stuff with Batman, like Bruce Wayne having lost his memory and Alfred not telling him so that he has a chance at a happy life, has been really good. And this has been, outside of what Snyder and Capullo are doing, the best treatment of it. And within what Snyder and Capullo are doing, probably the most relatable treatment of it, to be honest. Just really, really top-notch stuff. I love that book. I love those guys. They're so good. Also, what are you doing? Read Omega Men. It's great.
The other comic that we were going to talk about, or that you were going to talk about, is Scooby-Doo Team-Up number 23.
Yeah, this was the one where Scooby-Doo met Harley Quinn. Like, ever since Scooby-Doo Team-Up started, it's been a weird book. Because it's... when you think about all the stuff that Warner Brothers owns, that's what they have access to team up. So obviously the first couple were superhero stories. They did Batman, they did Wonder Woman, they did Superman. Then they did stuff, they did Flintstones and Jetsons, which, like, personally I don't care about, but I, you know, I feel like I am also not the target market for Scooby-Doo Team Up. It's very much a digital first all ages book, which I think is a cool thing to have. They did Secret Squirrel, and now they're kind of circling back to the superheroes, and it is the most charming version of Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn, because it's Harley and Ivy, and you find out that they have stolen, like a couple weeks ago, they stole an opal, and it's cursed, and now bad things keep happening to them, and there's no one else they can tell about it, so they lure Scooby and the gang to Gotham City. So you get to see, like it's Harley and Ivy having to call in Scooby-Doo to investigate this ghost that is giving them trouble, which is, like, it's charming. Like, that is the absolute word for it. It's fun, and it's just, like, kind of casually thrown out that, like, yeah, they have an apartment together. Like, it's half decorated with clown stuff and half with giant plants. It's just really, really fun and well worth checking out if you enjoy those kind of weird team up stories. Like, it is a vastly different comic book from, say, Archie vs. Predator. But if you like the kind of idea of weird team ups, then yeah, it's one you're going to enjoy.
Who's writing that book now? Is it still Sholly Fish?
Yeah, it's Sholly Fish, who, if you read the Batman Brave and the Bold comics, he wrote those, and he also wrote the backups in Morrison and Rags Morales' Action, too. So that is where most superhero readers will probably be most familiar with him.
All right. Well, that's it for our comic segment. Chris, let's just jump right in to answering some listener questions.
Let's do it.
Our first question actually comes via email from a Patreon line stepper, Brendan Casey.
Oh, thank you, Brendan.
Hey, guys. As someone who has loved and been fascinated with the game of poker since I was a kid, when my mom gave me the Fantastic Four volume of the Marvel Encyclopedia series when I was 10, you can imagine my excitement at the idea of the floating superhero poker tournament hosted by Ben Grimm and Jarvis. The idea of heroes getting together and shooting the shit over a friendly game of cards is something that I still enjoy today. My question, if War Rocket Ajax was to host the next floating superhero poker tournament, who would you invite and what drinks or food would you serve?
Now, I'm not a poker player. Matt, are you? Are you a cardsman?
I have played poker in the past. I haven't played it in a group in a very long time. And the game that I've played in casinos the very few times that I've played cards in a casino has been blackjack, because I like just playing card games that are just me and a dealer and not eight other people that I'm having to compete with. But I have played some poker in the past. I don't know what superheroes necessarily would be the best ones to bring into a poker game. I guess the bigger question is just, who would you want to like sit around a table with and hang out with for a night?
I mean, Bengrim.
Yeah, is, I mean, that's
the big one.
That right? Seems like the obvious choice.
I've always loved those comics where like Wonder Woman is like, you know, hanging out like when she's not off superheroing, like in those rare occasions when we see Wonder Woman, like, you know, go into a party with the other superheroes, or I'm almost positive there's a DC equivalent to that poker game that, you know, is very much an established Marvel Universe thing. But I want to say they've done it with the Justice League once or twice. And I know there have been, like, there's been a Wonder Woman scene. And Wonder Woman's always, like, Wonder Woman's a very fun character to see relaxing, you know? Because, yeah. Like, Superman is never going to, like, have a whole lot of fun. Like, Superman's going to be a good guy and help you move your couch. But he's not, like, he's not gonna get loose with you.
He's not going to let the hair down.
Yeah, that's, exactly. That's he's not going to let that 1994 hair down.
That's the trait that I kind of am thinking about the most for this. Like, who's just going to tell the best stories? Who's going to open up and really tell some stories? And I mean, we were just talking about him in the comic segment, but I feel like Dick Grayson, if you got him, you know, around the poker table and gave him enough drinks, even though I don't know if Dick Grayson would actually drink or not, but like if you got a couple drinks in him, he would just start telling like the stories about the most hilarious nights with him and Batman, you know, sitting around on rooftops, mistaking somebody for Killer Croc or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Dick Grayson with the, you know, the power of friendship is a good one.
Who else would be a storyteller? Who else would sit around that poker table and just really tell the best on the road stories or whatever?
Yeah, because, you know, like, Spider-Man's not going to do it. Spider-Man's going to be a grump.
Spider-Man's going to crack jokes or talk about how bad he is at poker or complain about how he's losing.
Or Spider-Man will be like, I'll take and then, like, you know, he'll get his spider sense and be like, no, I'm going to fold this round. I'm going to fold this round. Like, he would be terrible. He would be the worst to play with.
Yeah. I mean, as far as just like storytelling and also just general partying, Thor and Hercules would be pretty good candidates.
Yeah, but, like, I also feel like you don't want Hercules at your party.
That's true.
Like, you want to go to Hercules' party, but, like, you don't want Hercules to come to your party.
Your poker table is going to get broken at some point.
Yeah.
If he's there.
Like, I got a security deposit that I need to get back eventually.
Yeah. But then again, like, as far as just, like, partying and storytelling, those would kind of be the guys, right? Like, those would kind of be the ones.
Yeah, yeah. Like, definitely. Jeez. Yeah, those would kind of be the ones. You know, Wonder Woman, Dick Grayson, Ben Grimm. Is there anybody who's rich and dumb in comics? Everyone who's rich is also a super genius.
I mean, I'm sure there are characters who are rich and dumb. I don't know if they're actually superheroes. But I mean, they're definitely like financiers or villains for sure who are rich and not the brightest. I don't know about heroes though. Usually for whatever reason, the richest heroes are also like the brainiest.
Yeah, like Batman is like Batman's gonna be ruthless. Like Batman is no fun to play games with. You know that he's not,
and he's just gonna sit there silently. Like he's not gonna.
He's not going to tell you stories. He's not going to loosen up.
No. Not at all. Maybe The Flash.
Like Wally West? Not Barry Allen. Sure.
No, Barry Allen would just be very analytical about the game, right?
You mean the real Flash?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He would tell some stories, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of, like, the characters who are gregarious but not annoying. Like, Plastic Man would be the worst to have at a poker game, right? He'd be terrible. He'd just be so obnoxious.
Metamorpho would be a good one.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
Metamorpho would be a good one.
All right, do you have an idea? We've named plenty of names. Do you have an idea of what food or drink you would serve?
Pizza.
Yeah, pizza seems like...
We'd all get a pizza. Choice.
Or, you know, like, you know, game night food, bar food.
You were at my birthday party. You know I provide snacks.
Yeah.
You know that I make Dylan Todd's famous original sausage dip.
That's right. Chicken wings, chips and dip, you know, the traditional stuff. And then for drinks, I would say either rum and cokes or beer or you know, just packaged soda pops. If for the non-drinkers.
Soda and zesty.
Soda and zesty, that's right. Okay, I think that answers that question pretty well. So we're going to move on to a question from Twitter. And this one is from James Leach, James D. Leach on Twitter. What new podcasts have you guys been listening to? Chris, do you have any new favorite podcasts?
The ones that we have that are from friends of ours, the ones that we always talk about, Intuit is one that you should be checking out. Journey into Misery is one that you should be checking out. New podcasts? Oh, there actually is a new podcast that I've been listening to. You know that I do the Sailor Moon podcast, Sailor Business,
right.
Where Jordan D. White and I sit down with a guest every week and we watch go episode by episode. That was inspired by April Richardson's Saved by the Bell podcast, Go Bayside, which just recently came back for its final two episodes after a year gap. She's doing the movies. So she did Hawaiian Style and she's going to do Zach and Kelly getting married in Vegas in a couple weeks. But I got an email from someone who told me that she was inspired by Sailor Business to do an episode by episode gem podcast with two of her friends called the Gem Jam. and I'm really excited about it because, first of all, the first season of Gem is truly, I was going to say ridiculous, but I kind of have to say truly outrageous.
Sure.
It's super weird and great. And they're going through episode by episode, and they sound like they're having a really, really fun time. But definitely check out the Gem Jam, because it's a hoot. It's absolutely delightful. They also review the comics, and they're very excited about what Kelly Thompson and Sophie Campbell are doing on the IDW book, which of course they should be, because that book is great, which you already know if you listen to this show. I think that's the newest one that I listen to. Obviously, the best show with Tom Sharpling is my go-to. The Flophouse, The Dollop, our friends RJ and John's Columbo podcast, which is Just One More Thing. We've both been on that, and I want to go back on it.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great one.
And there's a really fun Super Sentai podcast that I listen to called The Super Sentai Brothers. They just finished doing Live and Let Die Ranger, where they went through every episode of Gosei Sentai Die Ranger. And now they're going through every episode of Jetman, and so the title of the podcast is Super Sentai Brothers, The Jetman with the Golden Gun. That has actually been an influence on what I'm doing with Ranger Station at Comics Alliance, because they're going through all the Super Sentai stuff that you might have seen from Die Ranger was used. Die Rangers were the White Ranger. When Tommy became the White Ranger, that's where that came from. So those episodes were never really used, but the monsters were. So it's cool to hear that stuff. Jetman was never adapted for America, so that's going to be all new. But definitely check those out. And I'm pretty sure those guys are listeners. In fact, I know they are, because they are supporters of the show on Patreon. So Dave and Matt, thank you for listening. So Jim Jam and Live and Let, the Jetman with the Golden Gun. Check those out. Matt, you got any good ones?
I haven't really started up on any new ones lately. I think I may have even recommended this on the show as a rec, but if you haven't listened to it, it has only gotten better and better. And that is Spontanea Nation with Paul F. Tompkins.
Oh, that is a good one. That
which
is a really good one.
Just a show where he does an interview segment with a guest, and then they take elements. He and a group of improvisers, which often includes Janet Varney from Legend of Korra, who was the voice of Korra,
Who is great, by the way.
She's wonderful, and she is often one of the improvisers. But he and a group of improvisers will then just do like a 30-minute improvised story based on that interview. And it is always very funny. I enjoy that podcast a lot. One that I tried recently that I kind of had to just like go cold turkey and stop on, and I'm so sad to say this, is Ric Flair's podcast. It's just not that good. I think I may have even talked about it on the show before. I don't remember. But there's just a sidekick guy who keeps doing like the station identification. And the show has the worst title, which is Woo Nation. And he's just saying it all the time. Like every couple questions in the interview, he'll be like, "This is Woo Nation."
And like you just dropped into a podcast?
Yeah. I do not care for it. It's not even that Ric Flair is a bad interviewer. He's pretty good, and he has on some pretty good guests. There was one episode where he was talking to David Crockett from, Crockett Promotions, the company that basically was WCW, or that evolved into WCW, that Ted Turner bought to make WCW. And they were just kind of shooting the breeze about the old days, and that was really interesting, but the format of that show kind of makes it really hard to listen to. All right.
What's his DraftKings promo code?
I don't know. I will say that Flair might be the best of anyone, with the exception of probably Jim Ross, among wrestling podcasters at reading ad copy, though. Flair's pretty good at talking, and he can do the ad copy fairly well. All right.
You have our word that you will never hear a DraftKings ad on War Rocket Ajax unless they pay us money.
Yeah.
In which case, all bets are off.
I was about to step in and be like, whoa, whoa, whoa there, Chris. All right. The next question is from Tumblr. This is from an anonymous person on Tumblr. They say, "I'm a recent wrestling convert, mostly via NXT. And when I watch classic era stuff, like matches with Bret Hart and Steve Austin, it seems so slow. Am I missing something, or do I have the wrong expectations?"
No, you're not. It's like wrestling has changed.
Yes.
Like the matches you're talking about are like the Bret Hart and Stone Cold stuff. Those are going to be 20 years old at this point, you know? Although I will say, I do think their match at WrestleMania 13 holds up. That match is awesome.
There are definitely some matches from that era that do hold up, but a lot of the stuff from around that time, there were kind of two separate worlds of the big guy heavyweight wrestling and then the cruiserweight stuff, which not until 97 or 98 did WWF or WWE actually even make an attempt to do any of that kind of thing, right? But I think you can really credit, you know, in WCW bringing in a lot of Japanese talent, a lot of luchadors, Mexican talent, who wrestled such a faster, kind of higher-flying, more dynamic style to American audiences suddenly being used to that. And now that is kind of like, it's kind of expected that matches, even with heavyweights, are going to include that kind of stuff.
And it's because a lot of people who got into wrestling coming up, like that are around now, came up watching stuff like, you know, in ECW you would have Super Crazy and Tajiri and like, you know, Rob Van Dam and Sabu, and they were taking these like huge jumps off the top rope. They were like, there was such fast paced stuff. That because people were kind of acknowledging, like, hey, this doesn't have to look real as long as it's exciting.
Yeah.
And then, you know, watching the Lucha Libre style stuff in Mexico that came up through Monday Nitro. And
right.
The Cruiserweights were always the anchor on that first hour of Nitro.
You had your Rey Mysterios. You had your Juventud Guerreras.
Psychosis.
Psychosis. You even psychosis. Had, like, you know, even like Eddie Guerrero was doing stuff that was pretty out there. Some really high flying stuff. You know, on a mainstream pro wrestling show that you hadn't seen all that much before.
But it's also because a lot of that stuff is foundational. You know, like if you go back and watch the Shawn Michaels Razor Ramon ladder match, like the first big ladder match in America, it's so boring because we've seen TLC, you know, because we've seen the Hardy Boys and Edge and Christian and Dudley Boys like hurt themselves so badly, like doing these huge stunts.
In the case of Edge, shortened their careers substantially.
Yes, yes, like without a doubt.
Yeah,
and you know, you see stuff like that, and then it becomes a matter of okay, well, how can we do this but not have it be so violent? So there's or have it be so violent to our own bodies, like so it switches back and forth, but. A lot of the stuff that you're going to see that's foundational. And I feel this way about like wrestling from the 80s, like watching Ricky Steamboat and Ric Flair go for 45 minutes is amazing. And watching like, you know, Steamboat and Savage, like that WrestleMania 3 match, it still holds up, but like everything else on those cards is like bores me to tears sometimes.
Yeah. All right, the next question is from Charlotte of Oz. This is... I think we might agree on this answer. We'll see. Charlotte's question is, what is the best video game console that was never as popular as it deserved to be? My answer for that is the Dreamcast.
Yeah. I mean, the Dreamcast... Dreamcast was hobbled out of the gate, man. Dreamcast was scratched at the gate because it was still using CDs.
It's a mix of that it was still using CDs and that it came out in the middle of a generation.
Yeah, it was the best console of a generation that just ended. It was like a year too late.
It was right in the middle, right? Cuz okay, the PlayStation, the first PlayStation came out in 95. The Nintendo 64 came out in 96. The Dreamcast hits in 99. So people who had spent their money on a console, either be it the Dreamcast or the PlayStation or the Nintendo 64, had dropped that money just not quite long enough ago to want to drop money on another console.
Right.
Three years later. Then... 2 years after the Dreamcast comes out, you get the PlayStation 2.
Yeah, and it's over. Yeah. You're done.
Yeah.
Because the PlayStation 2 is the best-selling console of all time.
Right.
So, and it was, you know, like, look, I had a Dreamcast, I loved the Dreamcast, and the Dreamcast had so many really great games. And that's the sad thing, is that it had these games that were better than what you were getting on PlayStation and N64, and like more innovative, like Space Channel 5 is on Dreamcast before Dance Dance Revolution really hits America, you know? And it's not quite the same thing, but they are those rhythm games, and Space Channel 5 had such a good aesthetic to it, and so, it was so fun, and had such a great soundtrack. But it's like this, you know... And it's one of the more prominent Dreamcast games, but it was a forgotten gem for such a long time.
There was no better system than the Dreamcast for fighting games. There were so many fighting game options on the Dreamcast, and I'm just gonna let this lead into another question from Twitter because I feel like we're already kind of answering it.
I will say, like, just real quick, I could not be more anti-Genesis, and I could not be more pro-Dreamcast.
Yeah. This is from Doubting Tom on Twitter. Following up on Charlotte of Oz's question, what's a game you liked but you never hear anyone talk about? And Space Channel 5, I feel like, you were leading toward that being the answer.
I mean, yeah, like, I loved Space Channel 5, but, you know, I wouldn't say, like, That's one that I do. I think there is a fan about there for it. Maybe just because I know Rusty Shackles. But yeah, I feel like people know about it. I feel like it was for the Dreamcast. It did well.
I feel like the other game that falls into that category is Shenmue, where it was on the Dreamcast, it does not get the massive attention that it might have if it was on the PlayStation. But people know it and remember it because it was such a different game.
Like, and you know that Shenmue 3 was on Kickstarter.
Yeah, and got funded, right? Like, and then some. So, people definitely remember Shenmue,
which was hilarious because they were like, "Yeah, we want like $3 million," and then everybody was like, "Yes, we will give you this money."
So, is there like a more hidden gem, Chris? Like a game that you just never hear anybody talk about that you really liked?
Rockin' Cats for the NES. That's all my right. go-to. That is my go-to obscure. Like, my go-to obscure NES game used to be Kabuki Quantum Fighter.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's too many people know about that one, which was amazingly weird. Because it was about a dude who was essentially projected into the Matrix, but his body became a Kabuki guy. And he would fight enemies with his hair. Did you ever play Rockin' Cats for the NES?
I did not.
It's this weird little platformer about a cartoon cat who's also a private detective. And he's like, you know, it's a weird little cartoon world where he's a PI and his girlfriend gets kidnapped or whatever. And he's walking, you know, going through this city, and he's got a gun, and the gun shoots a big boxing glove. And you can use it to jump, like you can use the cane in DuckTales. You can use it to swing from things. And the game is broken up into, instead of stages, it's channels, because he's going through all these, like he's a TV character. It's really clever and really fun. And I read about it in Nintendo Power and thought it sounded awesome. And then I went and played it, and I thought it was awesome. And I don't remember any, like, I've never met anyone who wants to talk about Rockin' Cats for the NES and how great it was.
I have two answers. One is Ikaruga for the Dreamcast, which was a space shooter and is, to my recollection, the best space shooter I've ever played, and nothing has knocked it from that title. It is exceedingly difficult, because the whole gimmick of Ikaruga is that you're not just flying around shooting other ships and shooting obstacles that are in your way. Ikaruga is a game that is entirely based around light and dark, and you have two different beams. You have a light beam and a dark beam, and you have to switch between the two of them to shoot whatever's in front of you. You have to shoot to the dark beam to fight light enemies, and you have to switch to the light beam to shoot light enemies. So it takes the old-fashioned space shooter and makes it that much more kind of imminently difficult by just adding that one little mechanism. It's kind of a brilliant game, and I really like it. The other one was an RPG I played on PlayStation 2. It was one of the earliest games to come out on PlayStation 2. And I remember buying it, and it's sort of unremarkable in a lot of ways. It's just a pretty good RPG that I enjoyed playing a lot, and that's Summoner. I really got into playing Summoner because it was like one of the only RPG options I had at the time. And nobody talks about it because better RPGs came out not long after that. But I remember investing a lot of time in that game and really liking it. So, those are my two answers. All right. The next question from Tumblr comes from Grantake. I hope I'm saying that name correctly. They ask, how do you think American comics would be different if there hadn't been a comics code? The simple answer is more genres, right? There wouldn't have just been, for the longest time, superhero comics. Because really, what the comics code, the comics environment that the comics code so drastically changed was one that had so many other genres. You know, westerns, horror comics, romance comics, war comics, which were really prevalent in the 50s. The comics landscape of the 1950s, comics were still very popular. Superhero comics, however, were kind of sliding back. They were kind of on the downturn. We don't remember, because we weren't alive, but we don't remember that the Flash didn't have a comic until he came back in Showcase. The only superhero comics that were still being published regularly into the 50s were basically Batman and Superman. That was it. And everything else had kind of fallen away in favor of these other genre comics. And the Comics Code, if you go and read the rules of it, was in many ways designed to do away with those genre comics, very specifically EC horror comics.
Yeah, like that's the thing about the Comics Code is that it was never meant to sanitize comics. Like it was never actually meant to clean things up or get rid of certain content. It was just meant to fuck over EC.
Yeah.
Like, the rules are specifically, like, you cannot publish a comic with the word crime in the title. You cannot publish a comic with the word horror in the title. You cannot, like, which are, like, which seem like the most weird arbitrary distinctions until you realize that, like, EC was publishing crime comics and Vault of Horror and all those comics. The genre shift in the 50s is really interesting to me. Because, obviously, you know, if you look at the careers of people who started in the 40s, if you look at Stan Lee, if you look at Jack Kirby, you'll see guys who went through the boom and then went through the bust. And, like, it's one of the things that I talked about when I read about Stan Lee. Like, that dude saw the comics industry collapse three times. Like, you cannot blame him for anything he does outside of comics because he watched it all go away three times. And it came back. But it was, you know, it can all go away. You know, the superheroes were kind of going bust and horror comics were really like the new hot genre. And I think if there's one thing that we've learned from the past decade, past 15 years, people love horror comics. Like, Walking Dead's a horror comic. Hellboy's a horror comic. Like, those are the comics that people outside of superhero fandom are drawn to. I personally like the superhero genre a lot, but it wouldn't look like what it looks like if the Comics Code hadn't happened, because it wouldn't have been allowed to develop in isolation the way it did. Like, the superhero genre, when you think about it, is fascinating.
Yeah.
Because they said in 1951, like 52, whenever the code came around, 55 maybe?
I think the actual year was 54.
54? Yeah. Like they said in 1954, they were like, hey, comics are just for kids. And they have to be dumb. Like they cannot be complex. They cannot be, you know, violent.
It all stemmed from an argument that comics are a bad influence on children. That's the whole point of Seduction of the Innocent. That comics are a bad influence on children, and they're making them illiterate.
And it's worth noting that Wortham thought the Comics Code was a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Wortham was like, no, they're still bad, you just made them stupid.
Yeah.
Made them worse.
The sort of way that the Comics Code was sold to people was that comics would present good moral stories where people in authority were presented in a positive light. Like, one of the rules of the Comics Code was that police could not be shown doing anything but good things.
Right.
You couldn't have an evil cop.
You couldn't have a crooked cop. You couldn't have... You couldn't tell any kind of crime story, really.
Other than Crime Doesn't Pay.
Which was the title of a comic that you could no longer publish.
That's right. Because it had crime in the title.
But the fascinating thing is, like, because comics were put into that corner, because comics were put into that box, the superhero genre evolved in a really unique and interesting way. The superhero genre has genre conventions that are not present in other media. Which is one of the reasons that, you know, I wrote about this and how the rule in the action in an action movie, right? Like like any Stallone or Chuck Norris or Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, like the rule in any action movie is that the good guy kills the bad guy at the end.
Yeah.
You can't do that in comics. So comics evolve genre conventions built around the idea that the good guy can't kill the bad guy.
Yeah.
So when they started making superhero movies and they were like, okay, well, they'll just be action movies. That's why they're so bad. That's why Batman 89 is such a huge piece of shit. Because the good guy kills the bad guy at the end.
I think Batman's got
like 30 years of, like 40 years at that point, of Batman not killing.
Right. But even longer. Like, the superheroes not killing, I feel like, goes back before even the comics code. The comics code just cemented it, right?
And yeah, like someone... Like, I wrote a column about Batman doing once, surprise, and someone talked about, like, I charted it. I was like, okay, Batman shoots a guy, like, Batman kills a guy in Detective 27, he shoots a gun in Detective 29. In 1941, which is less than 2 years after that, he tells Robin, remember, Robin, we never carry weapons or kill, we never kill with any weapon, and we don't carry any lethal weapons. And I'm like, yeah, that was 14 years before the comics code.
Yeah.
Because they had realized that, you know, who likes Batman? Kids. Who likes Superman? Kids. I think if you want to see what comics look like without the comics code, look at Japan.
I think looking at Japan is very, like, that's a good way to look at it, because Japanese comics have every genre you can imagine. Manga has, you know, tons of sports comics and adventure comics and comics for kids and comics for adults and comics for, you know, various groups, even defined by different names, right? Different names for different audiences. But I also think perception is a big part of it. Because let's be honest, like, the comics code starts in 1954. The genres started coming back by the 70s. You had horror comics again by the 70s. There were westerns again by the 1970s. Now, there are more genres than you might even suspect in comics, but the perception is that it's still all superheroes. To me, it's almost more of a perception thing than a reality thing. There is just this intrinsic link in comics between comics and superheroes, and in the mind of so many people, comics are just superheroes.
Yeah, because I think that's, you know, those were the comics produced by the comic book companies, you know?
Yeah.
The two, for so long, the two big comic book companies produced superhero comics, and even the westerns they were produced were kind of superhero westerns. You know, like, there are westerns in the 50s, but, like, In the mid-60s, when the Jonah Hex movie came out, I talked about how all the stuff that's cool about Jonah Hex in comics is cool because no one had done that in comics. And meanwhile, in westerns, you had morally compromised heroes. Like, in movies. You know, you had the Sergio Leone movies. You had the Django movies. You had all kinds of stuff that was pushing the genres. And, like, Jonah Hex is just, like he's a cool visual in comics. But yeah, like, I think if you want to see what happens, cause you look at manga, cause manga, like, segregated itself in a way that comics never got the chance to, because they were segregated externally. They were, you know, like, Congress, there were congressional hearings that came to the conclusion that comics were for kids. And meanwhile, in Japan, in the industry that really, you know, got started taking off in the 50s and 60s, you had comics that were for kids, and then you had comics that were for teenagers, and you had comics for young boys, and you had comics for young girls, and they developed all these genres that, even if they existed, were not mainstream within the comics industry. And they were mainstream in movies, in music, in television. Like, audiences were being served by other media, but comics weren't serving those audiences because we had been told by the government that they weren't. Which is very interesting. Like, because, you know, shonen manga has no stranger rules than superheroes. I was talking to David Brothers because I started reading Hunter x Hunter, and on his recommendation, because he was like, yeah, this is the most shonen comic there is. And I started reading it, and I'm like, wow, it really is. Like, it's these kids trying to get into a magic school for super badasses, and one of them talks about how his eyes grow scarlet when he gets passionate. I'm like, yeah, this is everything I wanted a shonen manga.
Let's move on to another question. This is from LOTR Dan on Twitter. I guess this is video game night with Twitter questions. Is Saints Row 3 or Saints Row the Third still the best video game of all time?
Yes.
Asked and answered. All right. Because that was a quick one, let's do another Twitter question. This is from our pal Ben Gully, Franz Ferdinand 2 on Twitter. What are the best boss fights in video games?
Whew, that's an interesting one. Matt, do you have a pick for a good boss fight?
My favorite boss fights are always the ones that make you think critically about a boss fight, right? Like something where you have to figure out some trick, or you have to... There's a strategy to it that's not just like dodge the boss's shots and get to a corner and shoot this one particular spot on the boss that's glowing yellow. My favorite boss fights are almost exclusively in the... Not exclusively. There's some other boss fights in other games I like a lot too, but I really like boss fights in the Metal Gear series. Sometimes those boss fights get a little too clever for their own good, or a little too, like, oh, you had to figure out the trick. Like in Metal Gear Solid 2, there's a boss fight that is literally just, don't do anything and hide behind a box until the boss decides to leave. That one is annoying as hell, because why would you think to do that, right? But some of the boss fights in, like, the first Metal Gear Solid, like, you know, everybody talks about, you know, Psycho Mantis and how you have to move the controller from the first player plug to the second player plug so he can't read your mind anymore. That is just, like, great. That's one of those kind of mind-blowing, oh, right, video games can do this kinds of things. But then there are other boss fights.
I don't want to cut you off, Matt, but everything I hear about the Metal Gear Solid games sounds like people are making it up. Having never played them, it sounds like you guys are just, like, screwing with me constantly.
Well, the games are kind of screwing with you constantly. But there are other boss fights in that game that I like just as much as the Psycho Mantis boss fight, even though they're a little more straightforward. Like the boss fight against Vulcan Raven, where it's basically a big maze, and you have to place mines in the right spots and make him go to the mines and hurt himself, right? Like, it's the stuff that's not just dodging, shooting the right spot, and then dodging again that I like the most. I also like it when boss fights have stages. That's part of why I like Metroid games so much. I always love, boss fights in Metroid games where not only do you need a strategy to fight the boss, but the boss is going to come in one way and then maybe change into something else as you go. Basically, every boss fight in Super Metroid is exhilarating and wonderful. Chris, do you have a candidate for your favorite boss fight?
Well, it's funny because boss fights, for me, are where games tend to fall apart. You know, like Mass Effect. Amazing game, right? Like, who doesn't love Mass Effect? And then you get to the boss fight and it's just you shoot a guy.
Yeah.
Like, none of what's cool about the game is represented in the boss fight. Arkham is the same way. Like, the Joker is not a physical threat, so they turn the Joker into a giant monster and you punch him with your bombs on your fist, which is dumb, like dumb to the point of being genius in the original Arkham Asylum. And then you get to the point where it's like games are just like there's this sweet spot that games have to hit between just being like a completely different thing and then being a thing that is so easy because you've done it for the whole game. Like you can get to the point in Symphony of the Night, one of the all-time greatest games, you can get to the point where you can just ace the boss fight in a second. Like you just destroy it. For me, what makes boss fights good is like when they are memorable for their staging or their music or the way they are presented. The presentation of a boss fight is what sticks with me. Like, I'm not a huge JRPG guy anymore, but that boss fight with Sephiroth is pretty great. Like, even when you like accidentally counter hit him to death, right?
Yeah,
I mean, because it has the music and it's got the weird design.
It's definitely got a sense of grandeur about it.
There's a
boss fight in Chrono Trigger that I remember for that same kind of dramatic moment sense to it, and it's not even the final boss fight. It's when you fight Magus in the big cathedral where he's got an organ, and you walk into the room and he's playing the. It's dark, and then these torches come on along the sides of the screen, and then he's standing in front of the organ and he's playing it. And then he turns around to you and asks why you're there, and then you face him down. Those are great moments.
The Saints Row the Third final level is great. It is completely unchallenging, but you know, Bonnie Tyler is playing, and you go to the Statue of Liberty, and, like, it's great. It's amazing. But the one that, like, really sticks out is Bayonetta, where you go to space and punch out God. Like, that's how to do it. That's how to do it.
All right, so I think our answers are, for you, it's more about the dramatic moment. For me, yeah. It's really about making me do something beyond just fighting a tougher version of the regular enemies in the game. Another example of great boss fights to me are every single boss in Shadow of the Colossus, where you have to figure out a strategy to fight this Colossus that is very different from the previous Colossus, because this one is an entirely different creature. With an entirely different weak spot that is designed differently. This one might walk on four legs instead of two legs. It might fly. It might swim. It might be huge. It might be smaller. That's the kind of stuff I like, where it's just like, make me think a little bit, you know? Make it a little bit of a puzzle and not just how long can you live and how hard can you hit.
The trick with that is that you have to do that. Like, you have to present something in a new way without making it something different, because there's nothing worse than a game that spends all this time teaching you how to do a specific thing, and then the last level comes around and you're not doing that thing. That was like 100% of my problem with L.A. Noire, which I hated. Like, I ended up hating, because the last level, you run through the sewer with a flamethrower.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, this is not a combat-oriented game. Like, that is not the point of the last 40 hours of my life.
That's one of the big problems with the original Devil May Cry.
The one where
it becomes a space shooter. Yeah.
Yeah, garbage. Yeah.
All right, here's a one last question from Tumblr. This is from Notice of Meowry. This is a question for you, Chris. Are you still happy with your drawing tablet?
I feel like this is a very passive-aggressive way of asking where my sketches are for, like, the last five episodes of
this question. This question is from way before that, so I don't think
Yeah. I mean, look, yeah, I'm going to get caught up this weekend. I'm going to try to anyway. But yeah, I am. It's very fun. It's interesting. I have not had time to sit down and draw, but yeah, I like doing it, and I like using that tablet. I can see why artists would prefer to do, like, sketches on paper and then finish them digitally, or ink digitally, but because it is, like, a different thing, and it is, like, a different feeling when you use it. But yeah, the tablet that I have, which is very basic, it's the Intuos, is it's great.
All right, we're going to do some rapid fire questions from Twitter to wrap up. Let's see how many of these we can get through. This one is from, again, from Tales to Enrage. Are either of you looking forward to Dark Knight Returns 3 for any reason?
What is that?
Yeah. Asked and answered. I might have been until I saw that the subtitle was The Master Race, and then I was like, no thanks. Okay. John Hex Lives asks, who is the best UK superhero?
Jack Staff.
Jack Staff. Yeah, I think we agree on that one. Captain Britain is also pretty cool. The next question is from Brad Can Do It. How pumped are you for the Lucha Underground Season 2 announcement that it is going to be happening?
I'm very excited. I actually have been saving Ultima Lucha because I didn't know if we were ever going to get more. So now I'm finally free to watch Ultima Lucha.
Oh, you're going to love it. You're going to love Ultima Lucha. And I'm over the moon that there's going to be a Lucha Underground Season 2. It's awesome. This is going to have to be our last question. This is from The Kais on Twitter. Where does the Spirit stand in the canon of great superhero characters? Other than the Eisner art, is he significant?
Look. Should I get up close on the mic on this one?
Yeah, Matt, please.
Do you think?
Please do.
I think I should get up close on the mic?
Yes.
It's overrated.
I do think the Spirit as a character, if the Spirit was that significant as a character, we wouldn't get these off and on books with the Spirit, and he wouldn't get tossed around between publishers like he does.
Yeah, the Spirit is not, the character is not what's worth noting about the Spirit, right? It's the layouts, it's the art, it's the format.
It's the creation of the language of comic books as we know it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, Will Eisner was no Jack Kirby, and that is where I come down on that.
But Will Eisner made some very notable and undeniable contributions to
comic art. He absolutely did. I just feel like because we're so far removed from the Spirit, you can see it. You can see its influence in things filtered through other things in a way that I think uses them. It uses that foundation in a way that I personally find more appealing. Whereas I still think no one has really matched Kirby. Those comics still hold up from the 70s. But I will say, go back and read any comic from 1940, any comic book format comic from 1940. And yeah, the Spirit is miles ahead of it. But so is Floyd Gottfredson. Those Floyd Gottfredson Mickey Mouse strips read like they're from, they don't read like they're from 1928. They don't read like they're from the mid-30s before Superman existed. There was a level, there is a level of quality and craftsmanship that you get from the Eisner and Iger stuff that is undeniable. Because most comic book format superheroes were being written and drawn by people who had no idea what they were doing, which is the fun of Golden Age comics. But Eisner and Jack Cole, Kirby's Golden Age stuff, that stuff reads like it's from the 50s or 60s, and it's from the 40s, and that's amazing. It's from the early 40s.
I feel
the character, Denny Colt, is not the cool thing about the Spirit.
Yeah, and I feel like those comics, to a modern reader, are you can revere them, you can respect them, you could ignore the racist caricatures, but they're a little hard to just sit down and read for fun. They're a little hard to enjoy. You can respect them, but I don't know that you can enjoy them. Which is how I feel a lot of foundational works are. You can respect what they have added to the language of the medium, without being these are my favorite comics. Because No Spirit comic is my favorite comic. I feel like the closest we've ever gotten to a good modern Spirit book is maybe that Darwin Cook run.
Well, no, I mean, like, the Darwin Cook run is good, and the current Matt Wagner run is really good.
Matt Wagner's doing good stuff with it, sure, as well. But like, I don't know, I feel like there is a reason why the Spirit is not a modern staple in comics, while other characters from that era, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Captain America, still are.
Yeah.
There's a level of being iconic to those characters that the Spirit, for whatever reason, just doesn't have.
What a lightning round question.
Yeah. Well, that was going to be the last one. I figured we wouldn't lightning round that one. But it is our last question. Thank you to everybody who sent in questions. We didn't get to all of them, and I apologize. But we tried to get through as many as we could. If you want to send us Twitter questions for a future episode, you can do that on Twitter at the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, or the ISB, that's Chris. You can also send us questions on Tumblr. You can do that by going to warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com and send us a question there. You can also send us questions by email. Our email address is warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. You can also send us Every Story Ever lists there. You can send us Word Heavyweight Champions lists. And you can also just send us comments or questions. Or if you want to sponsor the show, you can let us know right there at our email address. Be sure to check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. Also, be sure to check us out on iTunes. If you search for War Rocket Ajax on iTunes, that is where you will find the show. If you like the show, leave us a review there, please. We will appreciate it. And now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. For me, all you have to do is go to about.me/MattDWilson, and you will find links to all my stuff. I was not here when it came out, but I can tell you now that issue 7 of Copernicus Jones, Robot Detective, is available on Comixology. You can find a link to that on about.me, or you can just go to a Comixology and find it there. It is a single-issue, self-contained story, a quick little mystery in one issue. I really enjoyed writing it. It's about a comedy team, and you might like it, with art by Kevin Warren and letters by brand-new letterer Josh Kroc, who did a wonderful job. Both of them did a wonderful job on this issue. So go check that out and go see links to all my other stuff at about.me/MattDWilson. Chris, where can everybody find your stuff?
Everybody can find all of my stuff at about.me/ChrisSims. That has links to Twitter, Tumblr, Comics Alliance, my site, and Comixology, where you can buy all 8 chapters of the digital X-Men 92 Volume 1. Definitely go check that out if you haven't read it already. Look, it's got Wildside in it and Trevor Fitzroy. I don't know what else you guys need. Shatterstar shows up at the end. Shatterstar's pretty cool. Definitely check that out. Thank you all for listening. Seriously, thank you for supporting the book, and thank you for supporting me and Matt. I genuinely appreciate that. We will be back next week with another episode. We'll be back to our usual format with a cool guest on the way. This has been War Rocket Ajax number 273.
Text blowing up.
That's it, everybody. Have a great week.
Yeah! Stay on.